Thanks, Lars. And it's very nice to be back here. I have fond memories of my days here. I had a nice office, surfboard, view of Campus Point. It was over the top. And it's also my time here is what really convinced me to get into this business of gravitational wave. I'm very grateful, it turns out, to have been a good direction. All right, so I'm under instructions to make this targeted at the other program, which is a biology program. I see a troubling number of familiar faces, but there are some others. So I'm targeting it at the more general audience. I've tried to avoid jargon, though I'll no doubt slip into jargon. So for people in the rapid response program, there are times where it will seem like I'm really simplifying and you're going to get annoyed. And I don't want arguments about common envelope evolution and all the rest of it. Right, so I'm going to try to keep it at a high level and try to get across what we're doing and why I think at least it's interesting. So I think I'll actually start with a little outline. Okay. So the basic plan of attack is I'm going to give you just a very brief overview of gravitational waves. Then I'll talk about LIGO. Then I'll talk about black holes. Then I'll get to the main point, which is how do you make a black hole? And then, if there's time, I'll talk about the future. And just to be clear, okay, so this is all, we think it's been a fun year. This has been quite exciting. There's been a lot of discussion of these things. But what I think often falls by the wayside and what we're focusing on in the program is this issue of how do you make what we're detecting turns out to be related to stars. It's related to the earliest stars. It's related to metallicity, how stuff in the universe is made. So it's much more than just black holes. And so what this program is trying to do is go from what we've seen with LIGO to this much, much bigger questions about the universe. And so that's the overall thing. So just so that I can calibrate, how many people have never heard of LIGO? Okay, great. All right, that helps. Okay, so I'll get to LIGO in just a little bit. But let me start with gravitational waves. I'm going to abbreviate this GW. And needless to say, if you don't follow something I'm saying, please interrupt, please ask. I was warned that there should be lots of questions, and so I've only prepared 45 minutes, and I expect there to be questions. Okay. So any questions so far? Okay. So I'm going to start with a very hand-wavy heuristic just to get everyone on the same page about why gravitational waves exist. This is not a proof. It's just to give you some intuition. And it comes down to this. Your gravity attracts everything. And by this I mean, so each of you have some mass, and you're therefore attracting everything in the universe. There's no way to screen that. And so you're pulling on everything in the universe, including the most distant galaxies. Everything is being attracted to you, which is all well and good. Same with me, everything's being attracted to me. So the question now is, I'm pulling on all these distant galaxies. Now I go right over here, and now I'm pulling on all these distant galaxies, but from a slightly different view. And the question is, how do the galaxies figure out that I've moved? Okay? Because they have to know, no, I'm not falling this way, no, I'm kind of going that way. I'm just going to say this is not really the way we do it in general relativity. But it will give you some sense of what's happening. So if you move, How does the universe find out? And the point here is that in the old days, in the Newtonian days, you would say, well, it just, the universe updates automatically, immediately. But in relativity, one thing that everyone knows about general relativity is that nothing travels faster than the speed of light, and that includes information. Nothing can get out there. So it's not that when I move over here, the galaxies immediately readjust. That can't happen, because that would mean something's traveling infinitely fast. Instead, something has to go from me to those distant galaxies to say, he's moved. And that's a gravitational wave. So one way to say about it is, you emit gravitational waves when you move. These travel at the speed of light. And the point of these waves is, in some sense, the gravitational waves are how the universe keeps track of where everything is. That's the way it works in general relativity. So that's what a gravitational wave is. Now I'm going to kind of move forward. So before I go on, any questions so far? I should say this was predicted in 1916, 1917 by Einstein. And then there's been a lot of development on the topic. It took a few decades for the theory community to really come around. And then we've been working on detection for at least 40 years.
How does that relate to the idea that gravity is just the curvature of space? Is this like a wave in the curvature?
Yes, right, exactly. So the other way, the normal way people would say this is, well, gravitational waves are ripples in space-time. And that's exactly that picture of curved space. And so what you imagine is you have, in the normal way, think about it, you have a trampoline, for example, and that represents space. And then if you put a bowling ball on the trampoline, it curves that space, and then little marbles will roll around it. And now you imagine moving that bowling ball really fast, and it'll cause ripples in the trampoline. And it's exactly the same thing. You can think about it. When you move something on the trampoline or in space-time, it causes ripples, which then kind of adjust.
And then ripples can only move out at the speed of light.
That's right. That's right. And that's just an innate property of space-time. Right. Well, it has mass energy. So the question was, does a photon have mass? So, right, okay, so the question is, does a photon have mass? And if it doesn't, why is it attracted by a gravitational field? A short version of that, there are two things. First of all, so a photon has mass energy, so, equals mc squared, and so it does have a field, but that's very small. But more to the point for your question is, a photon just travels along its path. If space-time is curved, it'll also curve. It's not a function of the mass of the object. It's a function of whatever's curving the space-time. So around the sun causes its curvature in the trampoline. The photon is just like a marble. It's a very fast marble, but it's still a marble and notices the curve. So, other questions? Okay. All right. So that's kind of the background. Let me talk about LIGO. So LIGO is the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory. This is something that's been built over the last couple of decades. I think I'll draw a picture, since some people have not heard of this. It's a very simple picture. So this is, it's a Michelson interferometer. which means what you do is you have a laser, you shoot it into two arms, you have a beam splitter, the light goes back and forth, bounces off mirrors, recombines at your photodetector. Now, one thing I haven't mentioned about gravitational waves, you could ask, okay, this is all fine and good, what do gravitational waves actually do? And what you should have in mind for the main effect of gravitational waves is if you have any two distant points, so in my case, say, look at my hands, and I ask, what is the distance between me in the center and my hands? That starts to oscillate as a gravitational wave comes through. It's a very small oscillation. We'll talk about that a little bit. But that you get changes in distances. So as a gravitational wave passes through this, in some sense, the distance between the center mirror and the distant mirror changes, the relative distance between these two. And you're trying to detect that, and an interferometer is a perfect instrument to do that. One relevant quantity is that the arm lengths are 4 kilometers. And so this is a very giant interferometer, and it's a lot more complicated than this. There are lots of extra mirrors. The light is bouncing back and forth many, many times. Everything is isolated. We're trying to take out the motion of the Earth. This little picture really doesn't do it justice. This thing is a tour de force. So let me just write a few things about it. First of all, there are two detectors so far, one in Livingston, Louisiana, one in Hanford, Washington. And what you're really doing, in some sense, is you're just timing how long it takes for a photon to go down this tube compared to this tube. And it's the relative time that you're measuring. And you look at how that changes. And there's really only one thing you need to know about this. So I think it's fair to write this down. The relevant number for these sorts of things, if you take, and I'll talk more about this, but if you take what we consider a very strong source of gravitational waves, and you ask, what is the amplitude of the waves that you're passing us on Earth in, say, in the kilohertz band. So that is a specific band. But anyway, this is a very strong emitter. And you ask, what is the amplitude? The sorts of numbers you're talking about, 10 to the minus 21. So what we need to measure is changes in the relative distances of these mirrors to one point, 10 to the minus 21. And you know, even if you're a biologist or even worse, a string theorist, even then, this number should sound impossible. Right? This is a fraction of a proton on 4 kilometers. So it just doesn't make sense that we can do this, except that we can do it, and we're doing it now, and everything seems to be working. So that's what's happening. So this is remarkable. We could spend the next few weeks discussing some of the ins and outs of this. That's all I'm going to say about LIGO.
Can you still ask, the arms, the lengths of these arms, how the arm order is, instead of having 4 kilometers, you have, 40 kilometers, would it be more sensitive?
Yes. And it would scale directly with that. So in some sense, you can think we're measuring the absolute motions of these mirrors. And what we really care about is the fractional. So if you're 10 times longer, then you're 10 times more sensitive in amplitude.
What is the fractional change in wavelength of the problem?
Well, it's 10 to 1064. So it's comparable. Or less, sorry, it's much less. So it's much less than one period.
Right, but I was trying to comment.
Factor of, I think it's about 100, 10 to 100. So you could ask, how is it possible to measure, never mind the fact that the mirrors are huge on this scale, even at the atom scale, but the light you're putting in is huge compared to what we claim to measure. So how do you do that? And the short version of that is that there are a lot of photons in there. And they're very carefully calibrated photons. And so we pile it up. But it's...
Well, it's not the Gauss microscope by far. You're measuring...
It depends what you mean by microscope.
Milli photon radius. Whereas...
Yeah.
At the... I like to see the...
That's right. So in some sense, You know, it depends what you mean by resolving and what you're doing. But in terms of absolute numbers, okay, we can talk more. but you know, we'll discuss this after. So, you know, the point there is that the LHC is also, usually the way it's framed, LHC is the most complicated machine ever built. All right. And most expensive, that's right. LIGO's a bargain compared to the LHC. All right. So this was built and operated, in the early 2000s, and then it was shut down and upgraded over a period of about 5 years, and then turned back on. And so, the first science run. Which we call O1 was and that produced over that time about 50 days of data. So this, we turned it on, we have a bunch of data, and the main thing, which hopefully most people have heard about, is that on September 14th, we detected something, and you know, I'm under strict instructions, no slides, and there's a beautiful slide that we really want to show. And so I found this loophole, which is my shirt. So, because you have to see the real data, and I can't do justice. This is basically what I would draw, which is it's two detectors, Hanford and Livingston, and this is just what is in the detectors. Yeah. Well, you've never seen this, of course. So the point is, what you get here, I'll draw it a little bigger just in case. Is you get noise, and then it does something like this, which doesn't seem that spectacular. But this is essentially the raw data. It's been played with a little bit to take out various known sources of noise, but essentially this is just the raw data, and it does this in both detectors within the light travel time of the two instruments in phase. And that's what's shown by this little picture. And so it's hard to kind of get across what a big deal this was within the community. This is something many people said would never be able to do. And there it is. And you can actually see it by eye, which is kind of shocking. So we can talk a lot more about this. I will point out that this happened on September 14th, and we started on September 12th. So it happened very early. I think it's fair to say that at least for those of us, there are quite a few LIGO people in the audience. It's been a very intense time since September 14th. I think we're all pretty sleep deprived still, but it's been completely amazing. And this is what really, this little signal, it's a fraction of a second, has kicked off this whole new way of probing the universe. So I'll try to get some of that across. Now, there are a lot of details about this, which I'm not going to go into. How do we know it's real? How do we establish the false alarm rate? They're an incredible, how do we know the instruments are performing the way we think they are? All that I'm going to just skip. And I'm just going to go to I'm going to try to move towards more of the focus of our program. Okay. So, any questions so far? All right. So next. So I've now gone through gravitational waves and LIGO. Let's talk about this little set of wiggles we call GW, affectionately, GW150914. So what is it? And this gets me to parameter estimation. To understand a lot of what we're doing, you have to know how do we interpret what this is. Yes?
When you said people question whether it could ever be measured, did they question from an instrumentation point of view, from the point of view of there never being a source that's strong enough out there, or from the point of view of fundamental correction? I mean, fundamentally. So what was the...
So
all of the above?
I would say for all of the above except for the fundamental. I think, well, that's nice. So there was a period where people thought maybe gravitational waves didn't exist at all. That was a while, you know, maybe in the 20s and 30s, there were arguments about that. A lot of people thought that getting to this number of 10 to the minus 21 was unreasonable and that that wouldn't be possible. And I think even 15, 20 years ago, people were saying it's unlikely to work. There were also separate questions of do the sources even exist? And for a long time, there were arguments that certainly binary black holes might not exist. And to emphasize, which I'm going to say, well, you know, we had no particular evidence that they existed before. So on both sides, I would say it's very interesting. Yeah.
How often do you see those spikes? Like, how often do you see a gravitational wave?
Okay, so those were two different questions. How often do you see the spikes?
Yeah.
And how often do you see gravitational waves? So spikes we see all the time. And so that's, you know, it's a lot of our time is spent figuring out whether it's real or just a spike. And so that is, you know, you tell me how big you want the spike, and I'll tell you how often it happens. But for small spikes, you know, they'll happen every second. So we have to be very careful about that. For the real sources, I'll talk about that. That's the big question, which is how often do we detect these sources? And that's one of the key astrophysics measurements that we're interested in doing.
So I guess the universe must be filled with gravitational waves, and then you've got one happening way out there somewhere. And so how close would it have to be before the signature is just interfered with and down before it ever gets to you?
Right. So that's a terrific question. So the question was, you know, the universe is filled with these sources, and so they're washing through us all the time. And at some point, probably when you're far enough away, it gets lost in the background noise. And that's something we call the stochastic background. So we do think, especially with this measurement, now that there are sources all over the place, and these sources are emitting gravitational waves. As I'll talk about, much of the energy comes right at the end. So it gets really loud right at the end. So you can think of it as really what they're doing is they're making a sudden thump. But there are lots of those. The universe is really big. So they create a stochastic background.
But then does that background, is it the same in both of your instruments?
Yes. So you can correlate that and pull it out. Mm-hmm. But there is a stochastic background. And that's something completely new, which we're not talking about in this program, which I wasn't planning to talk about at all, but is completely fascinating. And one of the things that comes out of this is we do think there's a stochastic background, and we think it's within reach of LIGO. So it's very interesting. Well, what I'm talking about now is the things that pop above that. Yeah?
But she asked whether they're not damp.
Right.
They don't damp.
Yeah, so that's an extremely important point. So they don't damp. Yeah, so that's something I should emphasize here. So you emit these gravitational waves, you're going to have why? They're very weak. It's very hard to measure them. And that's bad because they're very hard to measure. It's taken us all this time. But it's good because it means that nothing interferes with them. The reason it's hard to measure is because they don't really wiggle your instrument. And they don't wiggle basically anything as they go through. So the gravitational waves come to us very cleanly. So unlike essentially all other probes we have of the universe, this is a very clean probe. They're emitted from deep down in the heart of some galaxy in some binary black hole, say. They emit the waves, and then they come to us absolutely pristine. We measure those waves. We have a beautiful view right up to the sort of surface of the black holes. And that's, you know, fantastic. And we can do that to the edge of the universe. So we think in the Big Bang itself, the gravitational refraction of a second after the Big Bang, we're emitting a bunch of gravitational waves. If we can measure those, we have an image, pristine image, from way back then, which it would be hard to do any other way. So that's, you know, that's what really makes you excited. That's a ways down the road. That's not advanced LIGO territory. But that's where we're headed now that we've taken this first step. Those are the sorts of things we want to do. But that's a very important point that they don't get obscured. Other questions? Okay. So back to this. So at the end of the day, what you really get in terms of the detector is this. And you need to turn this into some statement about what you've seen. And it's just some wiggles. So there's a whole business of parameter estimation. This is a big part of LIGO, is figuring out how to do this. Now, one of the things that makes this particular event so impressive is if you know just a little bit of general relativity, you can actually calculate just from my t-shirt, basically looking at my t-shirt, there's no time axis here, I just have to give you a time axis, you can figure out almost everything you need to know about this event. Because it's so loud, it pops up so high on my t-shirt that you can just figure things out. All you need to know is one equation, which Einstein wrote down, I think, in 1918, called the quadrupole formula, which just tells you how much energy is radiated in gravitational waves. If you have that, Kepler's laws, and conservation of energy, you can look at this, and you can calculate everything. And I gave this as a homework problem to my class. And it's, you know, undergrads can do it. It's a really beautiful event. This is an extreme event, but it's not representative, and that's not what we do in the collaboration. Though there is a paper, if you're interested, there's sort of an introductory physics paper about how to calculate that, which I believe should be on the archive now. So, right? The basic physics? Yeah. Okay, so you can go check that out if you want. And it's just hand-wavy scaling arguments, but give you almost everything you need to know. That's not what we really do. Yeah?
You said you only need the time axis, but I think the relative amplitude is not enough, right? Or do you need the absolute amplitude?
So the relative amplitude, so this is, in some sense, this measure, the relative amplitude, is the only measurement you have.
Okay.
And it's just those two arms, how much they relatively shift. Okay. That's the only amplitude measurement you have. If you want to know the distance, you need that as well. So that's a good point. If you only have time, I can just tell you the masses and basically what's going on. If you also want to know how far it is, then all you need is the amplitude. That's right. That's a good point.
Can you predict when you will have the next major ripple?
I can, statistically, I can predict.
Like in 100 years, or?
No. I'll get to that. That's a question about rate. And that is, that is the basic question. The first question you want to know is, okay, we've measured something, how often do they happen? So, just give me 5 more minutes, and I'll get to rate, and then we can talk more about that.
But we had a second question.
Yeah, so that's, I'm 2 miles away, yes. So let me, okay. So I can retrodict when the second detection will be, for sure. And the 2.9th detection as well. Okay. So the point here is, the way this really works in practice is we have general relativity. General relativity says if you take two black holes and you orbit them, or really any compact objects, they'll orbit around each other and they'll emit gravitational waves. And the way to think about that is now you have something that's, you know, very dense. It's a massive dense object, if you like, this black hole, and they're moving around each other quite rapidly, close to the speed of light, and they're changing their positions all the time. And so that's a very strong emitter of gravitational waves. And that's the sort of thing we hope to detect. Now, to figure out in detail what the gravitational wave emission is, we have to do numerical relativity. And we calculate this on a computer. And that's the way we solve general relativity to make a prediction. Yeah.
Is there a threshold in the size of the black hole or the object that you need in order for the wave to be detectable? And is that, could you change the instrument to change that threshold?
Right, that's an excellent question. So the question is there a threshold in your detector so that you can only detect certain black holes, and can you change that threshold? And so there is. The detector is sensitive over a range of frequency, and that range of frequency sets the range of mass that you can be sensitive to, that you can detect. So really what's going on here when I say you have this, even just this basic scaling argument, you can think, just use some intuition. What you have here is you have two black holes, they go around each other, they emit some energy and gravitational waves. They've lost energy, they have to get closer, which means they're going faster, which means they emit even more energy and get even closer and faster. And that's what we're detecting, and that's this part. And it goes all the way back, and that's what we call the chirp. It goes whoop, very distinctive, and that's what we measure. And if you like, there's a characteristic frequency scale attached to that, and that's the scale of the mass of the black holes. And we're sensitive to, you know, by design, if you like, we're sensitive to things down to about a solar mass, so the mass of our sun, two suns like ours, orbiting each other, up to maybe, you know, 50 solar masses each orbiting each other, maybe a little more.
And so that's, you can disentangle the speed in which they move around each other and their size.
Yes, so the size in almost everything I'm talking about is irrelevant until the very end stages. So we treat them as test particles. And then the only thing that varies is how far apart are they and how fast are they going. And that tells you the mass. So that's, you know, we built that over this tremendous range so that we can be sensitive to all of these.
But you need really two masses, because already one mass is not really, the sun is not rotating in the center of the mass, right? It's a bit...
right.
So already,
that's
the sun
right.
itself is...
The sun is wobbling. That's
so
right.
Already this wobbling would be, so each star, in fact, we could detect each star.
Yeah, so in principle, that's right. So the point here is that lots of things, why do we need two black holes? That's a very extreme case. Why can't we do it with the sun? And that's right, the sun is moving around. So first of all, it's moving around kind of slowly on these timescales, so we wouldn't be sensitive in this band. But also, the amount of gravitational waves that's emitted by the sun are way below this. I mean, if 10 to the minus 21 is hard, then it's, you know, 10 orders of magnitude below that or something. And so we're to get to this point where we can detect it at 10 to the minus 21, which is this incredible feat of engineering, we need these extreme sources. And that is a fundamental part of LIGO, is it's for extreme sources. This measures the extreme relativistic universe. That's a very important point.
So, if they move on, like the two black holes move on an ellipsoid, can you also compute the eccentrics of the ellipsoid? How do you?
Yes. So that's also a very interesting question. So the question was, so let's assume it's not a circular orbit, but it's eccentric. Can we measure that? And so that is. That we have strong prejudices, astrophysical prejudices, that won't happen, that they'll be circular by the time the black holes merge because of the emission of gravitational waves. Gravitational waves will circularize the binary. And, you know, it's pretty easy to see how that, you know, they move fastest when they're closest, they emit more gravitational waves, they'll slow down. So there's a strong prejudice that all binaries are circular, but we should still look for eccentric. And for some models, you might end up with eccentricity even close to the merger. And so that's something which we're discussing within the collaboration now, but hasn't been a focus so far. That's right. And this leads to, you know, a sort of generic question, which is, at the end of the day, for this parameter estimation, if you want to know what's really there, you have to understand the source, and you have to be able to simulate it. And there's a lot of stuff that's involved in those simulations, and then generating waveforms that we can actually use to do the data analysis problem. And that's a big business, which I won't. I mean, that's a whole other talk.
So shortly before the black holes merge, do they have just the same mass?
So that varies. So good. So let me go to this, what we've actually detected, and that'll directly address that. So we go through this whole parameter estimation. We analyze the data every second for 50 days, every fraction of a second, and we look, is there a black hole there? And if so, what are its parameters? And we keep doing that. And for the 50 days, we found 2.9 events. Okay. So that's in O1, in our first observing one. And so you could ask, okay, so we found two good events. This is one of them. This one, there's no doubt. The third event, this 0.9 event, you can ask, well, how, I've said, you have to be sure it's real. And how do you establish that? You have to ask, well, there's noise. As, you know, as we already discussed, the detector is ringing all the time. And so one of the things we have that really helps us is we have two detectors, and they both have to ring in the same way within the light travel time. Then we know it's real. And you can ask, how often does that happen with just pure noise? And that'll happen. We'll get unlucky. And so that's how we characterize whether something that has rung both detectors is real or not. And in one case, we think there's a 0.9 chance it's real, which is pretty good. I think most of us secretly believe it's real, but the statistics say we would not announce it as a detection. So we have two firm detections. There are two PRLs that are out there that you know, say, here's what we've detected, and then there's this other thing, which we're pretty sure. And then there are a bunch of other things which we're pretty sure are noise. Yeah.
Sorry, maybe I missed it. Why do you have 50 days of data if you run it for...
That's the experimenters. They don't know what they're... No, it's... So the point is, this is... It's 1.10 to 21 is really hard. So these things are shaking all the time. A truck drives by and we lose lock. Mm-hmm. That sort of thing. So they're very, very sensitive. We need both of these instruments up at the same time and behaving well. And at the end of the day, out of all this time, maybe half the time or a little less, we have both instruments working well. And that's how we end up with 50 days.
Your 2.9 is less than 2 sigma. So how impressed should we be?
Oh, no. So this is 2.9 events. The sigma for each event is very, very high.
Okay.
Except for the 0.91. The 0.91 is maybe 2 sigma or something, but the others are much greater than
0.91. Yeah, it's the 0.91 that I'm wondering.
Yeah, so the 0.91, I think, is roughly 2 sigma if you do kind of a formal thing. It's hard to know exactly what that means, and now you're talking about false alarm rates. That gets into inside baseball. But I would still say most people think it's real. And let me just show you the events. And I think part of it is that everything kind of fits, which is why we feel good about it. So,
how good was your LHD also?
Pardon? So, okay, vital statistics. So this is it. This is basically what we have from your taxpayer $500 million investment so far. What we've got is these three things. So this summarizes an incredible amount of work and this major technological event. This is what we have to show from this first observing run. So there are three events. These are the two sort of what we call confident detections, and this is the candidate event. And I'm just showing the mass of one black hole, the more massive one, the mass of the second black hole, and then how far away it is. And to get you oriented, this distance, 1 megaparsec, is, roughly speaking, the distance to the nearest galaxy. So, this is kind of a ways out, hundreds of galaxies away, but it's the universe is really big. This is pretty close by universe standards. And then these are the masses. So when we say 36, we mean you take 36 of our suns and you jam them all together and make a black hole out of it. That's what we've detected. Okay. So these are our three events.
So how do you know how far away?
So how far away was related to the question earlier of the amplitude.
Yeah.
So if you know the masses and you know the amplitude, you can more or less figure out how far away it is. There are degeneracies with inclination and other things. So these all have error bars. The error bars are quite large, especially on distance. So this is plus or minus 200 or so. That's something we'd really like to improve, and a lot of people here working on that. But it's basically the amplitude.
Can you look at the timing of the events in your two detectors and kind of narrow down?
Yes, further? Perfect, yes. So the question was, can you look at the timing in the two detectors and narrow down where it is on the sky? And that is something we do, and we do get localization. The localization is hundreds of square degrees. You can think of it as we're doing timing, triangulation, but we only have two detectors. So our ability to do that is somewhat limited. That's something we're very excited about for the future, where we hope to have a third detector called Virgo, which is a French-Italian collaboration. They're building a detector in Italy. And if that turns on, then we'll have three. We can do triangulation, and we'll do an order of magnitude better on all of this. But that's not right now. That's for the future.
So are all these binary black holes?
Yes. So the question, this is also for binary black holes. These are black hole masses. We don't think there are any other compact objects that get close to this. So if there were, then actually what we've measured is just consistent with black holes. Now, we think the next most compact object is a neutron star, and it probably doesn't get much past two or three solar masses. So that's really why we think they're binary black holes. There's some, and that's something we'll actually have a discussion this afternoon and at 2 o'clock, led by Alessandra, where we'll discuss more, you know, why do we think this is all agrees with GR? And that's also one way to say, why do we think these really are black holes?
Are the two events in totally different directions? The distance happens to be similar.
Yeah. So the fact that these two are similar distances is pure happenstance. The directions are not that dissimilar, but that's also happenstance. But I should also say these sky localizations are fairly large. You get these long strips on the sky. And so, you know, that they might overlap in places is not shocking. Mm-hmm. So there's a plot where you can see all three localization areas, and it's, you know, they're close, but they're not the same. And I should say, you know, at these sorts of distances, there's a lot of stuff out there, 400 megaparsecs.
But where is your, as far as distance goes, your sweet spot?
Amplitude goes down as one over R. That's one interesting aspect of, you know, gravitational wave detection. So that
if you go farther.
Right. So you can ask where. So by sweet spot, I think the way we normally say it is at threshold. I mean, if it's closer, it's always louder. But at threshold, sort of where, you know, so that's where most of the volume is. Where, you know, what's that distance? And that ends up being, it depends on the masses. So, you know, this event here is not that far from threshold. So this is lower mass, you know, a few hundred megaparsecs. This is well within threshold. Another way to say that is this is really much louder than we needed it to be. And so because it's so loud, you know it's much closer. Threshold here is probably maybe, you know, twice as far or more. I think, you know, strictly speaking, we might have seen that to a couple of gigaparsecs. So that one was unusually close. The very first event, which is part of the reason we're all so excited about it.
So, and like the question, like, how do you know that it's like a binary black hole and not just, could it be just a giant black hole but rotating like a little bit off its own self-center, like our sun does?
Yeah, so there is actually a model, you know, published, I won't say any names, you know, where, the, you know, someone says, This paper showed up a day or two after the announcement saying, oh, I have a model where I can create that. It's like a barbell because I have some disrupting something or the other. It turns out it's actually very, very difficult to do that. So we don't really have a model where it's something we discussed briefly last week. Can you have a massive star that has some sort of instability that would produce two of these things that kind of look like a binary? That's... In the realm of speculation, that's extremely speculative, I would say. But it's possible. But this waveform really looks exactly like just a vanilla two black holes with nothing else around.
So in fact, that's one of the things that makes them devalue, is they have this periodic kind of signature.
Right.
And I guess there must be a lot of things happening out there that wouldn't look that way, like I was reading about the two galaxies that collided,
yes.
Okay, so what would two galaxies colliding look like under?
So, okay, so this is going a little far afield, so I'll answer briefly. But so there are a few things. So first of all, two galaxies colliding, the time scale for that is much, much longer. So our detector measures things where it's happening on human time scale. And we also usually talk about hearing when we talk about gravitational wave detection. And the point here is that this is in the audible band, everything that we can measure with LIGO, more or less. So you need things that are moving a few times a second. And galaxies don't go that fast. So we would never detect that. But galaxies themselves you need them really moving relativistically to be interesting, and galaxies don't do that. Now, the black holes at the centers of the galaxies, when two galaxies collide, most galaxies have black holes at the center. Not these sorts of black holes. The black holes at the centers of galaxies are millions of solar masses. It's a whole different class. When I talk about how do you make the black holes, for everything we're doing with what we're talking about in this program, we're focused on these black holes. We're not worrying about the bigger ones, which are really hard to make as well, but are made some other way. So what we're talking about here is these. Now, the bigger black holes, they're at the center of galaxies. They find each other. They also emit gravitational waves. We're very interested in measuring those. We have two other ways to do that. One is to go to space. The ground shakes so much, too much for us to measure that because they're lower frequency because they're bigger. It takes longer to go around. So we can either go to space. That's something called LISA or ELISA, which our community is extremely excited about, and we hope will happen in the next... Well, I think the current plan is 2034. There might be a launch of a detector in space to do this. There's also pulsar timing, where you measure pulsars and you look at, you know, wobbles in the pulsars. And that's all for the supermassive black hole case, which is a whole other... And it brings up an important point. This is the first detection in this of gravitational waves. But gravitational waves is a whole band. So you can think of it as, you know, it's the first time you're measuring photons. And now you get to go on and measure different frequencies of photons. We'll measure different frequencies of gravitational waves. And so we'll see supermassive black holes. Maybe we'll see tiny little things. We don't know. We're just going to start measuring and see what's out there. Okay. So this is what we have so far. The question is, you know, what have we learned? Where do we go from here? I have another hour or so, is that right? okay, so I guess I'll cut to the chase. So we've done a number of things here. First, we have the first direct detection of gravitational waves in the laboratory. I would claim that's probably the least interesting thing we've done. I mean, it's a big deal. You know, there'll probably be some nice prizes associated with this. But we all kind of knew that gravitational waves existed. We had lots of indirect evidence for it. Now we've done it in the laboratory. That's great. It's also the first, I would claim, truly direct probe of black holes. And black holes, as a lot of people in this audience will tell you, are these, you know, incredible objects in physics, in all of science. I mean, there's something completely fascinating about them. They're very simple. It's a macroscopic object that's described by three numbers. So it's like a fundamental particle, but it's really big, the size of, you know, Santa Barbara in this, you know, in these cases. I mean, it's amazing that you can have this simple object, macroscopic object. And, you know, there's thermodynamics, there's quantum gravity, all this stuff is associated. This is the first time we have a real look at a black hole, we say that looks like an Einstein black hole. These things truly exist. There are lots of indirect evidence again, but it's remarkable that this stuff really is out there in our universe. Okay, so that's pretty good. From the point of view of this, I think it's another nice way to think about it. We talk about particle physics. We have these fundamental particles. We build the LHC. We slam them into each other. This is sort of a cosmic accelerator. This is like particle physics. We're taking these particles, these black holes. They're just as fundamental as from what we can tell in the universe, and we're slamming them into each other at roughly the speed of light. And then we see what comes out. And what comes out is the gravitational waves. So that's one way to think about what we're doing. Okay, that's all fine. One of the other things we're doing, this was the first direct detection, not just of black holes, but of binary black holes. This is the first time we know that there are two black holes spiraling around each other and merging. We had evidence of individual black holes with stellar companions. This is the first time we have real evidence of two black holes orbiting each other. In general, and this is, you know, something you might keep in mind, in general, we think if you have two black holes, there's not much other stuff around. Black holes are black. And so they're very dark, so it's very hard to see them in any other way. So gravitational waves are the way to detect these. Okay. This is also the first time we've detected, I erased the masses, but the first one was 36 and 20-something. These are massive black holes, much more than the mass of the sun. And that's the first time we have real evidence of black holes in our universe that are more than 20 solar masses, stellar mass black holes more than 20 solar masses. So these are all things we've just learned just from, and in fact, just from this first detection. Okay. And that's astrophysically very interesting. Yes?
Did anybody ever predict this kind of abundance, this level of abundance of black hole mergers?
Yes.
Why?
So that's my next point. Oh. So everyone is very focused on the rate. So let's just cut to the chase. The rate that we get is something like this. Okay. So this is the number of times per year, per part of space, that we think binary black holes will merge. Okay. Cubic gigaparsec is now, you know, a billion parsecs, so it's 3 billion light years. So it's a pretty big volume of space, but within that volume, this is the sort of rate we expect. Which, if you turn into, needless to say, if you turn this into predictions for LIGO, it ends up being around 3 per 50 days, because that's where this number is coming from. that's a good number. We like that number. So the key question here, which, given that I'm almost out of time, is relevant to everything in this program, is we're trying to understand where these black holes come from. We have models to describe that. And the models, now, they have to agree with these rates. They have to agree with the masses. They have to agree with the rates. And so whether people were surprised or not is a very contentious question. Since I'm up here, I get to say that a group of us, and this includes Chris Belchinsky and Tomek, who's here somewhere, there is Tomek and Richard O'Shaughnessy, and Chris Fryer has been part of this. Chris may be here somewhere. And anyway, there's a whole group, there he is. So we've been working on this for a while, and we published a paper, two papers before this, just before this, in the months before, saying we predict LIGO will see roughly this rate, and it'll see big black holes. So that being said, even though I'm being recalled, so, you know, so we predicted this, but even I was, you know, quite surprised. I think many people in the community were surprised because we'd never really seen these before. And it's one thing to make predictions, a whole other thing to really detect. And I'll also say, all these predictions, and this is what I had originally thought I would spend most of my time talking about, you can ask, how do you make these predictions? And to make the predictions for these, how do you interpret, you know, that the universe is making all these black holes? To do that, you have to have a model for how you make black holes. The basic model that we use is stars. Stars evolve, so they're born, they live, eventually they run out of fuel and they die and they collapse. And we sometimes the stars produce neutron stars, sometimes they produce white dwarfs, like our sun is expected to do, and sometimes they produce black holes. And exactly how that process works is not that well understood. But that's what we're trying to understand. You know, that's the goal here, is to understand that and to produce a population of these systems. And so we have different models to do that. There's an incredible amount of physics that goes into those models. And that's probably the main point to take away. Right, and that's an understatement. So the main point to take away is exactly that. What we do is in this game, what we're really doing here is, yes, we're detecting black holes. That's great. But what we're really doing is we're uncovering all the physics behind how stars live and die and form these black holes. And just to be clear, it's not just one black hole. So we think we have some handle on how to evolve one star into one black hole. There are lots of uncertainties. We have to know the mass. We have to know the composition, what we call metals. But you give me all that, I can spin arguments that at least some people would find compelling, yes, you'll produce a black hole. But we need to produce two black holes, and we need them to be really close on astronomical scales so that they merge and emit these gravitational waves. And that turns out to be much, much harder.
And your only constraint is the mass of the binary.
We have so here we have the masses and the spins. And then we, you know, on the line, we also have rates. And we have a lot of independent observational evidence because we see a lot of stars. And those stars have to be consistent. And then there even, and I think this is one of the messages we're getting from the program, is even beyond that, there are other things. We have, you know, X-ray binaries, we have supernovae, we have GRBs, and along the way of forming these things, we think these other events might happen. All the whole description has to fit together. So what we're trying to do is develop a story where these black holes that LIGO detects, and it's a very unique way to detect it, this population, we can now account for this population with everything else, with stars, with the metallicity in the universe, which is a very interesting constraint, to do all that at once. So that's our goal.
Yeah. So is it expected that the binary black holes came from binary stars, which each formed a black hole,
right,
or were these separate black holes which somehow...
Okay, so great. So this is at the core of this program, is that dichotomy. So you could, if you want to simplify everything down to what are you really trying to figure out, you can think of it, there are two basic models. A lot of people are going to get upset about this, but there are two basic models when you get down to it. One is you form two stars, they're nearby, and they're just in a binary, there's nothing else around, and they just evolve. One star becomes a black hole, another star eventually becomes a black hole, but they interact. And there are all these things. There are tides, there's this tidal interaction, there's this thing called common envelope where one black hole is inside the other star, and through this, you might end up close enough that you end up with two black holes that merge. That's one generic model. The other model is you have a bunch of stars, and there's just a high density of stars. And so they all evolve independently, more or less. And you end up with a bunch of black holes, and the black holes find each other. And there are all these three-body interactions that hardens the binaries. Eventually, you end up with a binary that's close enough, and it merges. Those are two completely different channels, and would love to be able to distinguish them. Now, there are a whole bunch of, you know, you can get into the details, and there, you know, there's this chemically homogeneous evolution, which is a particular version of that. There are all these other things, and that's what we're spending all our time discussing, is the other details. You could ask, okay, but can we, with these three events, just tell these two generic models apart? And the short answer is, if I say yes, I'm going to get really yelled at, so I'll say no. But that's what we're trying to do, is can we at least tell those basic models apart? And even that is contentious. And these are completely different models for how stars evolve. I think one thing we mostly agree on is in the coming years, with this rate, with the improvements we expect for LIGO, LIGO will turn back on slightly better in a few months at the end of September. And we hope to get more events. And as we fill out the mass distribution, as we fill out, in particular, the spin distribution, I mean, black holes have these very simple objects. One of the things they have is spin. And what the spins are and whether or not they're aligned is one of the major tools we have of unpacking what's happened. Very hard to measure that. But if we can measure that, then we start to be able to distinguish. So that's what we're all trying to figure out.
I just wanted you to maybe give them a comparison rate of how often in those units which are hard to understand, we believe a single black hole is made. So, compare that to the core collapse rate.
So,
on those same units. So they see.
Or maybe another way, this is once every 100,000 years.
That's right.
In a galaxy, like our own galaxy.
Right. Yeah, that's probably right. So that's
coming like 10,000.
So this is not a common rate, and the other rate is, one per maybe 100 years per galaxy. So this is quite unusual. And so if you're thinking other events that are spectacular, like supernovae, you could ask, how often does that happen? That's a pretty impressive event. We see those very far out. Those happen much more often. Now, the trick here is that...
That's sort of 100.
Factor of
1%.
Yeah.
Yeah, they have to merge, and then they have to merge.
That's right. And along the way, and that's relating to another thing. One of the things that happens in these models is when you're creating these black holes, we expect they're created perhaps in supernova explosions, and for some mass range that should happen, and then it had better be consistent. So there's just from the gravitational wave side, you look at this 2.9 events. Good luck constraining all this physics with 2.9 events. But it's 2.9 events plus a century of really impressive electromagnetic, conventional astronomy, and all that has to fit together.
Does data from conventional astronomy give you, depending on which model you use, gives you different sort of spatial maps of rates that you expect?
And I presume 10 years, 20 years down the line, when we had enough events, you can actually, is that how you propose to compare models? Just so, use the electromagnetic observations as a sort of, you know, thing that's going to tell you what the rate should be?
Right, so that's certainly something we'd like to do, and I think that's partly what Enrico was alluding to, is everything has to fit together. But more specifically on this issue of rates, one thing, a dream that at least many of us have here is, what I'm talking about is just pure gravitational waves. We just measure the gravitational waves. In principle, eventually we'll be able to localize the source, and we'll then be able to tell people, go point your telescopes. And for some of the population, we really hope that we'll be able to see electromagnetic counterparts. And then we identify the host galaxies. We can make statements about where are these things really, is it low metallicity dwarf? Like, where are these things coming from? And then we can really play that game. That's a little ways down the road, but maybe not that far. Maybe 5 years. We don't know.
Please. Related to how fast can you trigger an alert for this?
Right. So for this, and I think this is also something that hasn't been emphasized a lot just generally, is for this, we did issue alerts. We had electromagnetic partners, about 60 of them, and we told them for the very first event, we'd never done this, it was kind of a surprise, we nonetheless told them, we've seen something, go point your telescopes, this is where we think it is. For the first one, it took us about 3 days to do that. But in principle, we can do that much, much faster, maybe within seconds. If we really push it, maybe even earlier than that. So in principle, we can do that very quickly. The problem is, we don't want to be doing that for a bunch of garbage, and there's a lot of garbage in the data. Mm-hmm. And so that step has been taking us a while to sort out.
So what is the largest mass that you observe?
Right. So right now, the largest mass that we're sort of searching for is a total mass of about 100. But we can go to larger mass. Now, exactly what you mean by that then starts to depend on the type of search. So there are two ways to do searches. One is I know what I'm looking for, and I essentially do a match template. And the other is I'm just searching for energy, a burst. And if you allow me to do burst searches, it can go to even higher mass. Does someone know the limit on the burst search?
400 solar masses.
400 solar masses.
And how does your sensitivity depend on the... I mean, 20 gigahertz is millions of miles, but is there any talk of sort of going up in the... 100 kilometers.
So the future. Yeah. So the future. So let me first do the near term future. So the near term future is we turn on again in late September and we run for a total of about 6 months, and then we'll be down for maybe another 6 months, and then we'll turn on again with even more sensitivity and so on. And just that future going forward, we're probably talking about hundreds of black holes a year. So that's in the next few years we think we'll get there. Now you can ask, really, the next stage, and this is something that's been starting to be discussed much more urgently now, what do we do? The first thing is, the baseline is you have to go at least another order of magnitude. So instead of 4 kilometers, you want to do 40 kilometers. Another approach is to go underground. You control seismic noise that way. One of the major sources of noise is quantum, and you can control that by cooling your detectors, so being cryogenic. So depending on exactly what you want to focus on in terms of science, there are different things to do. But these are all very ambitious. This is very ambitious. So the timescale for this is 10 years or something. But yes, and the easiest, the longer you make it, the better your sensitivity. It scales directly. So without any real technological improvements, we just have to increase the size of the vacuum tube and we're all set. So that sounds easy. Modulo, the Earth curves, and you need a really big site.
All right, on that note, thank you.